Thank you, Neely. We love you too, Neely, and Neely is one of my favorites. And I've learned a lot from that girl. She's meant a lot to us. My name's Earl Lindsay, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everyone. And I'm an alcoholic who needs God, and I need Him each day. In our big book that we call Alcoholics Anonymous, on page 59, it's the fifth chapter, and how it works. And the second line on that page is, there is one who has all power. That one is God. And may you find Him now. And boy, do I need Him now. So you people just bear with me and we'll have a meeting. We might laugh a little, we might cry a little, but we'll have a meeting. I want to thank first the committee for inviting me here and allowing me to share with you people. Especially, I'm thrilled that I get to share with you on your 25th anniversary, the silver anniversary. I really like them. They match my hair. But it really has done a lot for me, and I really feel good that I'm getting to be here with you people. And you know the reason I'm here tonight is that you people kept coming, and you kept keeping the doors open, and was ready for me when I came in. Now, I haven't been here hardly as long as Neely did. She just started earlier than I did. And back in, when I come into the program was 1965, and if you remember, the birthday of their fellowship was 1935, and somebody called that to my attention and asked if it meant anything. For 30 years, 30 years later to the date, I found you people. I said, well, I had to wait 30 years to see whether it worked or not. So since it worked and you people let me, well, then I joined you. I've had plenty of instructions, you know. I've really got a good talk for you tonight if I can remember all those instructions. I got part of them coming down, driving down here, you know, and I got the rest of them after I got here. I got some this afternoon in the cafeteria out here. This friend of mine, Joe up at Atlanta, you know, told me about a ball game being out here, and I think he must have sent this person to me earlier. He went out early to go to this ball game, but this person comes and said, I'll tell you now how to make a real good AA talk. I said, that's exactly what I need to know. How do you do it? And he said, well, for a start with, you want to be sincere. Well, I thought, well, I'll try to be sincere. And then he says, be brief and be seated. So, I've got plenty of instructions. And then one of my most valued ones on my advisory board is instructed me not to try to say anything important, that I'd goof up somehow. So I'm going to, and then another down there talking to me about being honest and tell it like it is and all that. So I've got plenty of instructions now. If I can just follow them, well, we'll have a good meeting here tonight. I'm here tonight because I want to be here. I'm comfortable when I'm with you people, and I'm not comfortable when I'm without you kind of people, because I try to be a big book AA person, and I cannot be that and not be with you kind of people and go to AA meetings regularly. Sometimes I have to miss. I don't like to, but I'm comfortable when I'm with you people. Another reason I'm here is that I was invited. Now, you know, I didn't used to get invited to places like this. I might get invited to not come, but it was really, really nice to be invited down here to be with you people. There's many of you people out there that is responsible for a lot of this sobriety. You know who you are. You played a great part in my sobriety. And mainly by letting me still come and be with you and share with you in these meetings. And then again, another reason I'm here tonight is that I haven't had a drink today. And I haven't had for 16 days, 4 months, and 13 years. For that I'm very grateful, and I can say too, during that period of time, I have not wanted a drink, and I can tell you that truthfully. And I put it in that order because it's important that it be in that order. Because, you know, if I was drunk today, then all this other would be nil and void. It'd be no good. I wouldn't be up here. You wouldn't let me. So it's important that I do it one day at a time. And another thing that I, reason I love you people so much, I think I was born in Georgia. Now, we'd moved to Tennessee when I was about 6 or 8 years, something like that, but really I was born up here in north east Georgia in Murray County. Now, I'm not going to tell you about how long ago it was. I had a birthday last week, and Anita hadn't quit telling her. I quit telling how old I was. But I had a birthday a week ago today. And I've been around a while, I guarantee you that, Anita. And now, I was born up here at a little place called Ferry, Georgia. Now, I don't know. I've never been back there. I don't reckon, not since we left. And I can hardly tell you where Ferry, Georgia is. I wouldn't know how to tell you to get there. And I don't know myself. But I think the best way to get there is to be born there. And so you don't miss the target when you get here like that. And I was born in what you'd call a good Christian home. I imagine that my people were good people. And but you know, the further along I get, I begin to wonder whether that's a good place to be born or not. You hear so many alcoholics, I was born in a good Christian home. But that gets me to thinking that might be a breeding place for alcoholics. Now, I'm the oldest boy of three and three sisters. I have one sister older than me, and I've drank with all of them except one, which is a very religious girl. And I'm the only alcoholic in the group that I know of, and I have traced back on both sides of my family, and I can't find an alcoholic anywhere, but I reckon I was supposed to be. I wound up like that, and I've decided it wasn't my fault because I'm part of God's creation and He created me like that, and I was just supposed to be an alcoholic. So I tried to be a good one. I worked hard on that. And it's my belief today, and it hadn't always been, that I was born an alcoholic. Now you can, you've got to explain that to a lot of people, especially non-alcoholics. And why I'm an alcoholic. Now, if my mother was here tonight, she would tell you that I was sober that day, that I had no alcohol, beer, or anything else like that on my breath. Everything happened after I got here. And so many of you will understand my story a little better, maybe, as I'll tell you this to start with, that I didn't drink when I was young. I waited till I thought I could drink like a man, and I waited till I was 35 years old. I was 35 years old when I had my first drink. Now, many people have asked me, well, why did you start drinking at 35, or why did you wait that long? I don't know. If I could answer that question, I could answer a lot of questions for a lot of people. I was just, I think, born an alcoholic, and sooner or later I was destined to drink. And I just waited till I was 35 years old without any knowledge of why I did it. And I did not start drinking to become an alcoholic. That was not my intention. I had high ambitions. I wanted to be a governor of the state, a millionaire, or something like that. Certainly not an alcoholic. And I'm kind of like the little boy that lived in the country, and he went off down the road to a pond fishing, and he fell in. And, you know, the banks was kind of slick, and there he was having a hard time climbing back out, and this kind old lady came by and said, well, son, how'd you come to fall in? He said, I didn't come to fall in, I come to fish. So I didn't drink alcohol to become an alcoholic. I was already that and didn't know it. I was, born with an imbalance of chemical in my body, and And then, too, I can look back now and see the little characteristics and the traits and all that thing. But you see, I had nothing to measure them by as they were happening. I thought that was just a normal thing for boys growing up. But, you know, people today talk about us being abnormal people, us doing these crazy things and all. But, you know, if we wasn't doing those crazy things, we wouldn't be here. That's normal for an alcoholic. And, you know, it takes a lot of work to get here. It takes a lot of work. It takes years and a lot of liquor and a lot of money and a lot of heartaches and heartbreaks and all that to get here. But I don't know any other way to get here. And the good thing about it, the good part about it, all this suffering, all this, it's worth it all to just find that you people are here waiting on when I get here. I think if I had the power to do it and I was not alcoholic today and I knew about you people and there's no other way to get here, I'd start drinking tonight. I could be qualified to join you people. I always have a little throat problem when I get up before you. I'm not nervous, I know that, but it's something that causes my throat to act up a little bit when I seem like every time I'm engaged to talk. Now, I lived pretty much of a normal life when I was growing up. And I didn't drink, but I didn't run around with people that that drank. I wouldn't have anything to do with you if you had anything to do with alcohol. I had such resentment against that because it broke up my home. My daddy left when I was 15 or 16 years old, and I haven't seen him since. I don't know whether he's an alcoholic or not, but I grew up resenting alcohol or resenting you if you drink alcohol. I'd just stay away from you. And I did things that was normal for a child growing up. After that, I worked and made my own money. I carried papers. I mowed yards and all those things, you know, until after he had left. And I went to work in a grocery store. And I've only had two jobs in my life. I worked in one store 5 years, from the time I was 14 till I was 19. And from the time I was 19 till I was 24. And since that time, I've been in business for myself. So I didn't give up trying to make a living and trying to make it honest, and did very well at it. And, you know, start drinking in life late is not the only thing I did late either. I have with me tonight this pretty little blonde you've seen me run around with out here. You know, I found out later that God has a heaven full of angels, and I doubt if he has one he'd do without, but now to 37 years ago, he loaned me one, and I still have her, and she's with me tonight, and she's sitting over here. I'd like for you people, if you haven't met her, to meet her after the meeting. Cooper, I wish you'd stand up just once. We will soon have been married 37 years. Now, I've had a ball. I don't know how she stood it. Maybe you can hear her story sometime. But it's been great. And I met her when I was 27 years old. Now, I don't know if any of you men have been single and free and all that at 27 years old and live in a little town and a pretty blonde come to town and kind of walking down the street with that the right kind of little wiggle that a girl 20 years old is supposed to have, you know. And I'll tell you, it turned me on. And tell you the truth, she went off and forgot to turn me off, too. But I kept on till I got acquainted with that girl and found out that she was already engaged to be married, and I wanted her, and that's the only girl in my life I'd seen that I was willing to spend the rest of my life with. And, you know, I had to work hard. But, you know, an alcoholic can do that when he sets his mind, and I had to work day and night. And it took me almost a year to convince her that she should marry me instead of that other guy. And so we've had 37 years of good marriage. Now, approximately 2 years after this marriage, there's a little girl born to us, and that was the sweetest, most beautiful little girl you've ever seen in your life. And you people that have little girls, if you don't feel that way about your little girl, I suggest you go back and take another look, because they're exactly what I tell you mine is. And it was approximately 3 months after that until we were to learn that we were to have no more children of our own. So we had to be satisfied with this one, and I don't think God ever put any more in one little package than he did her. So we enjoyed her, and I don't remember ever wishing that I had a boy or a girl, because she filled the bill. She would go with me to Chattanooga and places like that, 60 miles from where I lived, in big trucks and everything, just be with me and to get to look at, they had a better variety of funny books, you know, than our dime store had. So she filled the bill. And today, when I started drinking when I was 35, she was 4 years old. And then when I found you people 17 years later, you see, she was 21. So you can see what portion of her life that I took away from her, the privilege of having a sober daddy. But today, I think God's letting me relive that, because she's got a little daughter now. I've got a granddaughter 4 years old and a grandson 8 years old, or nine, I believe. And this little girl is more like her mother was at the time that I remember when she was 4 years old. And I think God is letting me relive and go through that, and I'm really enjoying it. You know, any of you people, if you don't know how great grandchildren are, just ask Grandpa. He can tell you. So we went on, and Cooper worked with me in the store, and then on till 7 years later, from the time I was 28 and we got married, until I was 35. And I had an obsession to work, to make money, and I was determined to have those things that I was deprived of when I was growing up as a child, because the boys that I went to school with, and they had the privilege of going on to school and I didn't. And I resented that too. I just grew up with a bunch of resentments against people and things. And I didn't even have a car to drive, you know, and they did. And I worked hard. I worked 14 years without missing a day of work. And you're looking at a man that went 62 years without spending one day sick in a bed in his life. God has been very good to me. 62 years. And 3 years ago, I'll keep on to you, I'll tell you how old I am. 3 years ago, I had a little heart attack, and I think I spent 5 or 6 days in bed then. And that's the extent of my illness. And I think God has been very good to me. And these people that I was in business with in Etowah, I was raised up at Etowah, Tennessee, now when I moved from Georgia. But before I got up there, let me back up and get this a little bit. I missed a little portion I think it might be necessary so you understand a little better some of the other. When my daddy went on to Etowah, when he went to work, and I was about 5 or 6 years old, and we stayed at my granddaddy's, and my granddaddy was a Bible-reading, praying man, and we were made to sit down in the living room and listen to him read the Bible and get down on our knees in the chair and listen to him pray. Well, at that time, there was no doubt in my mind that there wasn't some power or somewhere to answer those prayers, but I couldn't see it. He was telling me about a God way out there in the sky, you know, and he's a great white bearded man, and he was judging us, and he was going to condemn you for that and eventually burn you up. And I couldn't love God, you, or no one else that was threatening to burn me up. Well, when I was a child, if I died, I didn't want to go to heaven. I was afraid I'd meet that God up there, you know, and he'd punish me for these things. And he would always threaten me with that. Some of you might have heard, I believe it was Johnny Cash, I know I've heard him sing it, that wrote this song, God's Gonna Get You For That. That song wasn't new to me. I heard that years ago. And I had a pretty good vision of the devil. My grandmother told me about that. She would say, well, I'd be into something. She's trying to get me to do something else, you know, and she'd say, listen, you hear the devil coming with chains, rather, you know, he's going to wrap you up and take you off. And I grew up like that. I went to church and Sunday school when I was young because it was a thing to do, and the neighbors were going, and I went, I think, mostly that. But for that reason. When I was in this business in Etowah, and I had never been to a ball game. And that's when the drinking started. I want to talk to you about that. I don't want to give you a lot of drink logs or lead up to this. You've heard all that. Because when I get up here and tell you that I'm an alcoholic, if you're the kind of alcoholic I am, you know my story from then on. You could tell it. The only thing different from it and your story was it was happening to me. It was happening to me. And so I'm not going to bother you with a lot of that. And the big book tells us there's a pattern that we should tell what it used to be like, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. I'm going to touch on that, and I'm also going to try to inject enough in there because I think a good alcoholic would like to know, well, where are you now, and how did you get here? Where are you now? And I think that's important to us. It's important to me. And I like to know how I get here, and today I know how I got here. I got here by keep coming to meetings and meeting with you people. And that's how I got here, and that's why I'm here tonight, is you people. So these people, one of them was my brother. There were three couples, and they bought me a season ticket to Tennessee ball games to get me to go to a ball game with them. Now, I'd been to high school football game, but I'd never been to a college game. So I went with them. And if you know where Etowah is, up on Highway 411 and 60 miles south of Knoxville, and we'd go from Etowah to Knoxville, was 60 miles. And this first Saturday, and it was sometime this time of year, it was the fall, it was the first game of the season. It could have been the latter week in September, first of October, somewhere along like that. And you know, going to this ball game, there were six of us couples, was Cooper and I, and my brother and his wife, and another fellow and his wife, and we went up there. I didn't know my brother drank, and I've already told you I wouldn't associate with you if you were drinking, but they drank going to that ball game, but it didn't seem to bother me. I didn't seem to see anything wrong with it. It wasn't the kind of drinking that I had seen around where I live, this old country drunk drinking, you know, like I finally wound up doing. You know. But they seemed to drink, and they was drinking something and chasing it with something, and they was laughing and having a good time. And that was my first ball game, and I was eating hot dogs and chasing with Coca-Cola, and I wouldn't have no good time. But I changed that situation the next week when we went to, we got ready to go to the ball game in Knoxville, and us being three couples, and each three of us had cars, and it was this week for us to drive our car. So I was driving, going up Highway 411 towards Knoxville, and hadn't got very far out of Etowah, when someone handed me a paper cup with something in it. And it was a cup about the size of the coffee cups you use. And that taught me a lesson that I remember today, is always be careful what you take in your hand. You might drink it. And I drank that. I drank that whatever's in that cup. I didn't know what it was. And I found out later it was gin. Gin with a little ginger ale in it, you know. And I didn't know what a drink was supposed to taste like. That was my first one. And if I ever took a social drink in my life, that was it. And it lasted from the time it left my throat until it hit the pit of my stomach, and really I don't think it stopped there because I felt it come on out the end of my toes. I felt my toes tingle. It's just like swallowing an umbrella and opening it up on the inside. I think my body was just as dry as a sponge, and it waited 35 years to absorb this alcohol. And it absorbed it. And I don't know if you fellas remember your first drink or not, but it done, I think, exactly what it was supposed to do, your first drink, and it might have done it in double portions, because, you see, I had waited a long time for it. And it made me feel about 10 foot tall. I was always kind of shy and backward and didn't talk much, if you can imagine that about me. And it made me feel tall, and it made me see double and feel single. It did all the things that a drink is supposed to do, I guess. I just wondered, well, where's this magic been all my life, you know, because I had been missing a lot of things. Well, if I had taken that second drink because I wanted it, I wouldn't be up here talking to you tonight, because I would not be an alcoholic. I took that second drink because I had to have it. I don't know if any of you have experienced anything like that or not, but I had all the remorse and the guilt feeling that I had, and because I had done here what I had been against all my life. And not knowing that I was an alcoholic, and not knowing that us alcoholics are supposed to blame you or your wife or somebody else with it, I was trying to absorb all that myself. And I had to have another drink so I could stand the guilt and the remorse and everything that I had there, and not knowing that I needed to blame it on someone else. And I tried to carry that all myself. Now, I don't think I got drunk that day. We only had, I think I found out later, 1/5 for 6 people. But, and I wish I could tell you that was the last drinking, but it wasn't. That was just the beginning. And it's the time I've said that I boast an awful lot of sobriety in my life. I was sober one time for 35 years, and I had a slip that lasts for 17 years. That's how long I drank. So from then on, it was not a daily drink. I was not a daily drinker. It was just weekend drinking to start with. There was liquor in our house, and I could leave it alone, but it wasn't always like that. And then, too, shortly after that, I became what I can look back now was alcoholic drinking. You know, you people, many of you have heard and know that when you get to the morning drink that you're already doing alcoholic drinking. Well, you see, this first drink that I took was in the morning. I started off that way. And most of the time from then on, I was drinking when the morning come. And then, too, I forgot what I was going to tell you there. But anyway, I was drinking in the morning. And again, too, I was drinking while I was driving. And, you know, from then on, for 17 years, I drank all the time when I was driving. I only got caught DWI one time. I don't think that was my fault. The state patrol said I almost run over a roadblock. I don't think I did, because I didn't see him. But it taught me one thing there, that an alcoholic drinking pretty heavy, he can't make decisions. And I found that out many times. But, you know, when you're going down the road and a police car pulled up behind you with that siren screaming and there's red lights back then, them red lights are flashing, that gets your attention, and the first thing you do is hit the brake and you stop right quick. Well, when I stopped right quick, there's a pint bottle slid out from under the seat that I didn't know was there. It had about that much left in it. I'd already drank all I knew about, and I really needed a drink. And when that stopped, and by the time the police got up to my window, I was sitting there with that pint of liquor in my hand, and I found out then I couldn't make a decision. Because I was trying to decide whether to poke it back under the seat, throw it out the window, or drink it. And, you know, I couldn't make a decision, so he had to make it for me. He just reached over and got it. Of course, that was another charge, you know, possession. So, driving that 17 years without an accident, and then after I got sober, I bought a new car and wrecked it 6 times the first year. Well, you see, I tell people now, I can drive better drunk than I can sober. I can prove it. But I wish I could tell you that was the last drunk and the last jail I was in, but it wasn't. And you know, being locked up in jail and everything is not a qualification for becoming joining Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just one of the things that goes along with it. And I made the jail more times than that. And now I did things that maybe some of you people did. I done some odd things too, because I want to tell you just a few little incidents, and then I'll do what somebody told me. They'd be brief and be seated. But this drinking, you notice I told you that that I didn't start drinking until I was 35, and I was started off so far behind, and I did everything, I guess, that you did, and some more, too. I did everything that practicing alcoholic was capable of doing. Now, during this time that I was drinking so much, I was elected Sunday school superintendent. Can you imagine that? I had left Etowah, Tennessee, and a lot of you talk about a geographical tour or cure or whatever, but this tour that I made, I closed my business up in Cleveland, Tennessee, and went to Dayton, Ohio, because a brother of mine wanted me to go up there and go in business with him, and I locked up a big business and lost a lot of money, and went up there and guess what kind of business he was in? Wholesale beer business. Now, I'll tell you, if there's anything that an alcoholic needs to get out there in a hurry, is a warehouse full of beer. And when we was on, any of you know anything about Dayton, we was on the south end of Main Street there, and out the front door and up the street and down the street on each corner was a liquor store. And the place we lived, I mean a bar, and the place we lived in was north of town. Between the office and home was 7 liquor stores. You know, a lot of people have trouble with alcohol. I didn't. We didn't have any trouble drinking. We had plenty of alcohol. I had a living problem. Well, I stayed up there for, I think, 2 years. And I guess it saved my life that some people come by and wanted to buy us out, and we sold. Now, we didn't move the family up there. Cook and the little girl stayed home, and they continued to go into church and Sunday school. I was raised in the church. And there's nothing wrong with the church, but I didn't find the answer there. I didn't find the answer until I found you people. Then I found everything that I've been looking for all my life. But while I was up there, and they kept going to Sunday school and church, and when I come back, somebody told this minister what a fine fellow Earl Henry was. They remembered me when I didn't drink, when I went to Sunday school and church, you know, and they started in wanting me to be Sunday school superintendent. Now, this was the largest Methodist church in this town. Now, there might be some of you Baptists out there, too, that I'm not talking about just the Methodists that drink. Now, I don't know how many drank when I went to that church, but I'll guarantee you one thing, there's a lot of them when I left. And so I didn't want to be Sunday school superintendent because I knew it'd mess up my drinking, and I wasn't the kind of person they needed for a Sunday school superintendent. I got along with people good, yes, and finally, they kept asking me. So one Sunday, they had a board meeting. They have an official board in there, you know, and I finally agreed to be Sunday school superintendent and get back in the church and be the kind of person that people thought I was. It was important to me back then that you thought I was a good person, you know. It didn't make any difference what you see me doing out here at night and all that stuff, you know, but I wanted you to think I was a good person. I thought, well, if they've got that much faith in me and confidence in me, that I will just stop drinking and I'll live the kind of life I should. And I imagine that was the longest span of sobriety in my drinking years. And it lasts from Sunday afternoon until Saturday morning. So, I was in town on Saturday morning. You know, they have an official board in the Methodist Church, and if you elected Sunday school superintendent, you're an ex officio member or something like that, you know. And I met a member of the board in Saturday morning in town, and they said, "Boy, I'd like to have a drink, wouldn't you?" When I see this person didn't know that they couldn't ask an alcoholic like me a question like that. Of course I wanted a drink. Bourbon, I was dying for a drink. Bourbon was my favorite drink. If I had a choice, I'd take bourbon. I'd usually start off with bourbon. I'd usually wind up drinking anything that's too thin to chew. I was really wanting a drink. You could take a little shot glass about like that of bourbon, put on top of my head and my tongue, and slap my brains out trying to get it. So I was really wanting a drink real bad. So that just started the ball rolling. And That lasts now for about 5 years. I was Sunday school superintendent. And they changed preachers every once in a while, you know, in the Methodist church. And they got a new preacher there, and I think he is a little smarter than this other one was, because he detected that right off, what is wrong with Earl Lindsay. So I thought, well, I'll go to Cleveland. So I moved my business in 1959 to Cleveland. I've been commuting, and I started commuting for 30 miles there and back each day, and that's when the blackout started. I was one of them blackout kind of fellas. I'd start drinking in Cleveland today, and I'd wake up somewhere else tomorrow wondering how I got there. And that scared me. And later, that is what prompted us to move to Cleveland. And tell you the truth, I think that was work of Providence, because I'd have never found AA if I hadn't got to Cleveland, Tennessee, like I did. And that's where I found this great fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But this new minister and this sister of mine that I'd never drink with, I was in Cleveland drinking one day, my wife was out of town, and I was on one of them kind of drunks you can pitch when your wife's out of town, I thought in the afternoon that I would just get me a new bottle, and I'd go home, and I'd finish this up. Well, I got home, and with a new bottle, and I hadn't got settled good until someone knocked on my door, and it was this sister of mine and this new minister, and they wanted to talk to me. And they come in, and I didn't have anything to talk to them about, really, but I listened a few minutes, and they sit in on me about this drinking, you know, and I don't, you know enough about an alcoholic, you can't talk to him when he's drinking or if he's wanting to drink. So that was back in my big shot days. I was driving a four-door Fleetwood Cadillac, big black sedan, and I'm not a bad kind of a guy, but when they got kind of bearing down on me a little bit, why, I just got my bottle, and I reached over and got my 38, and I went out the front door, and I got in that car, and I thought, I'll go to Cleveland and finish up my drinking. Well, I didn't know it till later, but this minister called the law and told them that they was a guy leaving Etowah, and he's headed for Cleveland, and he was drunk, and he was armed, and he was dangerous. You see, back at that time, you bought your license, I think you do today, by county, you know. I had Bradley County tagged on my car, but I lived in McMinn. Well, when I got down to the river bridge, where Hiawassee River divides McMinn County and Bradley County, it's a long steel bridge. As I went across the bridge there, the sheriff had a roadblock set up. And when I drove up, why, he motioned me on. You see, he wasn't looking for me. He was looking for that bad guy that the preacher called him about. And when I got on to town and pulled up in front of the office, and I found out that those city police, they kind of listen to them radios too, you know, and they got the message. And they were sitting down there waiting on me. But I pulled up and got out and went in the office. I took my bottle and I took me a drink. And I've got a parking lot there, large enough to park 30 trucks. And I looked out the front window, and I left that Cadillac sitting right in the middle of the street. So I thought, well, I better pull it up in the yard. So I went out there to move the car, and that's when the police swarmed the car. I didn't know Cleveland had that many police. But they was pretty nice to me. They parked my car, and they took my pistol, and they took me to jail for my first time. Now, I don't know whether you people know what a jail door sounds like or not, a big steel door, especially if you're on the wrong side of it. It don't sound good. And those people up there, they don't 12-step you like you people do either. They don't pour you no coffee, no. They don't ask you which bed you want, and they just give you one of the old steel bunks, and you stay there. And, of course, I've had enough alcohol in me to be mouthy, you know, and I wanted to call my lawyer, and they wouldn't let me because at that time my lawyer was mayor of that town, and they thought I was lying, you know, and they made me stay in there till the next morning. And when they let me call my lawyer and he came down, why, he got me out, got my gun back and all that stuff, you know, and I don't know. It might have made me find you people a little quicker if they'd been a little harder on me at that time. But then again, I don't think that if I had the power to go back and change anything, that I would change it, because it might, the whole thing might crumble in and I wouldn't find you people, because I think I'm very fortunate that I made it all the way until I found you. Now, when I was drinking, and I've heard many of y'all tell your story, and I don't think that you were capable of doing anything that I didn't do. I done everything. I touched all bases. And I imagine, I think if I'd missed any, I'd went back and got them. I done everything that a drinking alcoholic is capable of doing. Now, some of you have heard Dave from Dallas talk about he's done everything except willfully murder another human being or make love to another man. Now, I didn't do any of that either. And there's something else that I've heard some of you people do, you know, or tell the story. You know, I was a blackout too. I've heard of men talking about being in a blackout and waking up some morning in a motel and look over and see somebody laying there and say, "Who are you?" And they said, "Well, I'm that pretty Indian princess you was out with last night." Now, I didn't do that either. The one I come to with or woke up with looked like $1 million. And the reason I say that is I've never seen $1 million, but she sure looked like something I'd never seen before. So I think I've done it all, and I'm qualified to be here. again, you know, and when I was Sunday school superintendent, I was still drinking. I was drinking heavy, and it got worse. And I was going to town one day, and passed this young lady walking to town. She's a Sunday school superintendent. I thought I'd pick her up and take her to town, you know. And she wanted to talk a while and ride, and that suited me. And I smoked at that time, and I offered her a cigarette, and oh, she didn't smoke, you know. While I'd been just about as long as I could without a drink, I had a pint on my front seat that time. And I got the pint out, and I offered her a drink, and she said, "No, she just didn't drink, you know." So I said, "You don't mind if I take one?" "No, that's all right." Well, the drunker I got, and the further down the road I got, in this beautiful motel, you know, all lit up, and I said something about that, and well, that was all right. Go in there and didn't see anything wrong with that, I reckon, you know. And so the next morning I sobered up and come to, and I said, "I want you to tell me something." I said, "You wouldn't take a cigarette and smoke, and you wouldn't take a drink of liquor, but you come in here and spend the night with me." And she said, "Well, that's what I've been trying to teach my Sunday school children. You can have a good time without smoking and drinking." So you see, when I was young and growing up and 35 and you people smoking and drinking, I was still having a good time. But that things that happen to you happen to me, and a lot of times we think our story is different, but I guess it's not. It just happens at different times. And I think mine, maybe the only difference in it and yours is that I waited until I was 35 years old. And I think the later you wait in life, the quicker it tears you down, because by the time I was 52 years, I had had all that I had cared to take. And you're looking at a man that was 52 years old and never heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know you people. I didn't know you exist. I think we're too anonymous. And you know us alcoholics that are sober today, and I believe it was Neither and I talking today, that we're miracles. Miracles. They know you that are living here, living sober and here today. I think those of us that are here are the most fortunate people in the world, in that our disease has reflected itself in alcoholism, and we have found through this great fellowship what we can do about it. We don't have to drink anymore. We don't have to sober up anymore. We don't have to shake and sweat anymore. You can go through any graveyard you want to here in your town or any town and look at them names on the tombstones, the ones that died with an early age and didn't know what was wrong with them, you see. You see, we found out before it was too late. And we're very fortunate here tonight. And I heard a figure, and I don't know how authentic it is, but for every one that comes into Alcoholics Anonymous, one out of 35 make it. Now, can you sit there and imagine with each of you here tonight, and for each one that's here, there's 35 that's not here? We're very fortunate people. You know, before Alcoholics Anonymous, they were dead, dying like flies. And they didn't know what was wrong with them. And the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous might not be the greatest thing the world will ever see for the alcoholic, but it's the greatest thing we've seen yet. So I wish that each and every one that I'd come in contact with and you would come in contact wanted what we want. If they would, they'd be here or somewhere in a meeting tonight. And my grandmother, I mentioned her a while ago, she's a pretty sharp woman too. I believe if she's living today, that she'd find a way to make these alcoholics want to get in here. Well, when I was young and living up there in North Georgia, and she lived there too, but a little far away, and you know, she was better worker with children than my mother was, and I'd be playing out on the lot, you know, with ragged pants on and shirt, and I'd run in the afternoon to get a jelly sandwich or something like that, and she was hollering at me to put my shirt tail in, and I'd run out the door eating with one hand and poking that shirt tail with the other, you know. And well, when my grandmother come over to visit, I think I just had about one shirt back then, and I got up one morning and they'd washed my shirt. They had to wash me at night, you know, but my grandmother was going to make me want to keep that shirt tail in. So some of you ladies have seen, remember these old petticoats, I think, y'all had a lot of lace on the bottom of them, you know. She cut some lace off of one of them and sewed lace on the tail end of my shirt. And you know that made me want to keep that shirt tail in, because I didn't want them boys seeing me running around with lace on my shirt tail. And I believe she'd come up with something that'd make these people want Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, if I'm going to be brief enough, that ball game, Joe, I'm going to have to hurry, so I'll get in fast to the last drink. And I think I told you about the first drink, and I'll tell you about the last, and you can put the rest of it together, because everything that happened to you happened to me. And I went through it all, and I've already told you I did everything that drinking alcoholic is capable of doing, and I might have done some things that others wasn't capable of doing. Because, you see, I was in blackouts so much that I just remember about half of what went on. Well, you see, when I get up to talk to you people, I only tell you about half of what's left that I know, so really you're getting about 25% of it, you see. I might have enough come back to me, I might get honest enough to tell you all of it someday, but I'm going to be careful what I tell you today. But on this last drunk that I was on, I divide my 17 years of drinking up into three categories. The first 10 years I drank because I wanted to drink. Now, alcohol was not too unkind to me during that time. We had good times at parties, and we had good times drinking at ball games and things like that. But I can look back now, and it started to work, and it worked fast, because you know that it always gets worse. It never gets better. And I worked on it hard. But then the 10 years that I wanted to drink, and then 5 years that I drank because I needed a drink. I needed a drink to go. I needed a drink to get up on. I needed a drink to go to bed on. Then the last 2 years I drank because I had to drink. I just hadn't found a way to live without alcohol. It was just torture. I was afraid to wake up in the night, you know, without a drink. And I finally got to where I saw to it that I had one hid somewhere. If I could just hold it in my hand, I was all right. If I just knew it was there, maybe not take a drink just yet, but if I had it where I could get to it, I was all right. But it literally scared me to death to wake up without a drink. Now, during these last 2 years, when I was trying to stop drinking myself, I didn't know anything about you people, and I didn't know that I needed help. And I was 52 years old before I found the power greater than anything I ever knew in my life. I found the power of God. Now, I had been talking to this God or this power greater than us that I called God at that time, but I was not honest. I was asking Him to take away from me the desire to drink. But you see, I was not honest with Him. I wasn't ready not just yet to stop drinking. I was kind of like the guy that some fellow told the story of, that he was praying to God that He help him with his alcohol problem, but he says, "Now, God, if you busy," he said, "don't be in no hurry, because I'm enjoying what I'm doing." So I was kind of like that, you know. I was wanting to quit sometime, but not just yet. Really, I was wanting to quit hurting, you know. But I wasn't ready to stop drinking yet. And then when I was trying to stop drinking, I would go all day sometime without a drink. And I was trying to do this by myself. And then by the time 5 o'clock would come in the afternoon, I would start selling myself on the idea that, well, you've worked hard today and you need a drink. You deserve one. So I would go down to our favorite bootlegger. We don't have liquor stores there. And I would get a half a pint. And you know, I'm not a half a pint man. Usually it would take a half a pint to make me one big drink. And on the way down after, I'd entertain the idea of making it last me 2 days. You know, us alcoholics, we can figure these things before we take that first drink. But then I'd go get that half a pint, and I'd start home, I'd take me a drink, and I don't remember once getting home before I turned around and went back and got the rest of it. I just couldn't quit drinking. And I tried everything in the book that I could think of. I thought, well, if it takes 12 drinks to get me drunk, I'm going to drink 11 and quit. But whoever's seen an alcoholic could count his drinks. I'd get up to 7 or 8, and I'd get thinking, well, I missed fourth or fifth drink. I'd go back and get it. And I don't remember ever getting up to 11. I'd either black out or pass out or run out of liquor, you know. But this day, and it was on June the 9th, 1965, and I was on one of them kind of drunks that you can get on when your wife's away from home, and she didn't object to me drinking at home. She had rather I would do it, but just didn't want me to drink too much. And I would hide bottles from her, and then all this heavy drinking, we had 2 bootleggers in this town, and I figured this out, too, that they're both nice people, and I should divide my business with them, you know, because I drank so much. But then after I began to get a little bit sober and a little bit honest, I found out that what I was doing that for, I was ashamed for either one of them bootleggers to know how much liquor I drank. I'd trade with one at night and the other in daytime, then I'd switch it around, but I was working hard to keep them from knowing how much liquor I drank. And I look back now and I did my wife the same way, tried to hide bottles from her and all that, you know, was really ashamed of it. But this day that I woke up and she was in Hot Springs, Arkansas with her sister, the one that's up there now that's sick with rheumatoid arthritis, and I woke up this morning on June the 9th and I was shaking and I was hurting and I was coming apart. And I started one of them things like praying. I know you people never did do that, is, "Lord, get me over this and I'll never do it again." Always want to get over this one, you know. And I'm glad I got honest with myself that day and started talking back to myself. And I said, "Earl, you know God knows you're lying to Him. You might as well get honest with Him." And for the first time in my life, I got honest with Earl Lindsay and got honest with God. And I got down on my knees in that couch that's still sitting in my home now. Many of you've been there. We haven't even had it covered. We call it a drunk couch. I'd lay there and I'd drink and I'd watch TV. It didn't make any difference whether it's plugged in or not. I got a good picture, and I got covered pictures a long time before you people come on the network. But I got down on my knees and I asked God to help me. And I don't know if any of y'all have ever felt the presence of Him in the room with you or not, but eventually you will if you haven't already, if you get as sick as I did. And I was asking God to help me, and I said, "God, can you help me?" And it just come as clear as if He was there, and He was in His spirit, and said, "Earl, you're nothing but a low-down drunken bum. Until you stop drinking, no one can help you, not even me, not even me." Well, you know, you think right off that when you get to where the divine can't help you, there's nothing else you can do, but there is. Because, you see, he didn't take the choice away from me then, even. But he said, until you stop drinking. And I couldn't stop drinking. But you see, back in the Bible days, my Bible tells me about a guy that come to a pool that erupted. And he felt if he could roll over in that when the pool erupted, that he would be healed. And my Bible tells me that he had come there for 30 years. And he was there one day when the master walked by, and he asked the master if he could help him. And he told him to take up his bed and walk. And he did that. Then you all know the story of Lazarus. He had died and was in the tomb, and his body decomposing for 3 days. And when the master come and told him to come forth, he got up and walked out. You see, any miracle that Christ performed, he would have you do something first. And now I had to stop drinking, and I couldn't stop drinking. And I got up from that couch and pretty much in a blackout. Now, this minister that I called, and Pete Wasser, some of you I think know him, Joe, you did. And his story's in the big book. It's at Rum Radio and Rebellion. He had moved to Cleveland, Tennessee, and he'd come there from Pittsburgh. And he'd went to Pittsburgh from Akron. And he knew Bill and Bob both personally, on a first-name basis. And I don't believe anything in the world except he'd come there to lead me to you people. But I got up and I went to the telephone in a blackout, and I dialed a number that I had never seen before, not knowingly, and called a church that I didn't know was there, certainly didn't know that AA met there, and a kind voice answered the phone. And he told me this now, the minister of this Episcopal church in Cleveland, Tennessee, some of you have been there. And he answered the phone, and he told me that he got out of me. He knew I was sick when I called, and he got my name and where I live. And he come out there, and I asked him if he could help me, and he said no. Now, up until this time, I had aggravated all the preachers in that town that would listen to me. I have seen them cross the street to keep from speaking to me. Now, that's how bad it was. I got so low down, I'd have to carry a possum out of my arm and get the dogs to bark at me. That's how bad I got. But this minister come out there, and he asked me if I wouldn't, and I asked him if he could help me, and he said no. And he said, wouldn't you like to talk to, but I can take you to someone that can, he said. And he said, wouldn't you like to talk to someone from Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, I don't want anything to do with that bunch of drunks. So, of course, that's not exactly the words he told me, I said. I think I made it a little stronger than that. See, I didn't know who you people were. I think I must have been connecting Alcoholics Anonymous with this alcohol that I was trying to get loose from. And guess what I was drinking? I was drinking Ancient Age. But I wasn't calling it Ancient Age, I was calling it AA. These two bootleggers that I told you I traded with, they both stocked it because they wanted to keep what their best customer wanted. And when I went in, they didn't pick up anything else. They just wanted to know if I wanted a pint or a fifth or how many. Now, I was calling it AA. So, you see, I was getting AA a long time before I found you people. So, he must have convinced me because Pete Washer come over that day. And he talked to me, and I don't remember very much what about or anything until he told me later. People 12-step a little bit different back then, I think, than they do today, because that afternoon, Pete must have got the word around to the group, because there were 3 other men come that afternoon to see me. And especially this time of year, near the Christmas season, I speak of them as the wise men, because they were wise. They knew how to stay sober, and I didn't. And they come to see me that day, that afternoon, and you know, today, not a one of those men are in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them died a short time after I come into AA, I think approximately 2 years or maybe 3. But he died sober. He was on a 12-step call when he had a heart attack, and they called me, and by the time I got to the hospital, he was gone. The second guy chose to go back drinking, and he wound up somewhere in a mental institution and died with a wet brain. And this third man has not seen the need for AA, and he's back drinking again, and he don't want to talk to me. But I think that God got those 3 men together long enough to helped me to find you people. And I'm glad that they come by that day. And of course, Pete, he lived on for about 12 years, sometime within the last 12 months. He passed away. He was down at Clearwater, Florida, and he died sober with approximately 30 years. So I think these men got together long enough for me to find you people. And that was on June the 9th, 1965, and our meeting at that time was on Thursday night, and that was the 10th of June. And the next morning when I got up, I had the granddaddy ball shake. I was coming apart. I must have had some more to drink that night. And I was really shaking, and I remembered something the doctor had told me. There's a doctor in the family, and he's the only doctor left who would see me. They all told me not to come back. And he told me if I was going to stop drinking, or to not cut it off sudden, like to taper off. And I remembered that, and I went by and got a half a pint that day on June the 10th on the way to the office, and I must have been taking just a spoonful at a time because a half pint wouldn't have lasted me that long. I got it. I usually go to the office about 8 or 8:30, and at 2 o'clock that afternoon on June 10th, I finished that half pint. And that today is the last drink that I've had. It was 2 o'clock Thursday afternoon on June the 10th, 1965. And for that, I'm so grateful. And I couldn't have done that without you people. You know, you people and me too, we run from things. I run from people like the minister. They was trying to send me to hell, you know, and the police trying to put you in jail. We was running for something, running from something. The doctors wouldn't see you no more, telling you not to come back. And I was running from them, and my psychiatrist told me if I didn't pay him, he'd let me go crazy. So we all come here for running, you know, running from something. But as of today, that is the last drink that I have had. And for that, I'm very grateful. And I really appreciate you people listening to me and letting me come down and share with you the experience that I've had and telling you how much you mean to me and how I appreciate you letting me come. And as you people go into the comforts of your room or your home tonight and you bow your head in prayer and thank God for your sobriety, I hope you'll thank him for mine too. Thank you so much.